You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded December 4th, 2024. Well, 14 months into the daily murder and destruction in Gaza, Israel still denies what it is doing there is genocide. And finally, I agree. While what it is doing is definitely genocide within the legal lexicon, the way Israel is going about this heinous project transcends even that. More than merely causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, Israel is ensuring when wounds are suffered, they cannot be healed. More than deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, Israel is making certain ameliorating those conditions is impossible even after military actions cease. No, what Israel has been doing, is continuing to do, is not genocide. It is more properly recognized as a Holocaust. Dr. Dorothea Gucciardo is research coordinator for the Starling Center for Just Societies and Technologies at Western University, where she also teaches history. Dorothea, too, volunteers with the GLIA project, serving as its director of development, overseeing capacity building projects in Gaza. Dorothea's Open Gaza Initiative project was disrupted by Israel's attacks against Rafah last April, and her work refocused to organizing and leading medical missions within the embattled Gaza Strip. Now back in Canada, Dr. Gucciardo has joined a growing number of medical professions, giving testimony to a variety of national and international bodies in a desperate attempt to both raise awareness and move Canadians still supporting Israel to cease their support to save Palestinian lives. Dorothea Gucciardo in the first half. And not every country in the Western Hemisphere supports the ongoing Holocaust in Palestine. In fact, some have faced, too, the same kinds of sanctions and blockades, coups and assassination attempts that make genocide possible. Venezuela is certainly one of those, but despite more than 20 years in empire's crosshairs, it remains steadfastly defiant. More than this, though, the South American nation is actively rallying smaller countries to resist as it has done, in part by hosting the first anti-fascist Youth and Student World Congress held in Caracas last month. Victoria's Tyson Strandlin attended the Congress by invitation of the Venezuelan Foreign Affairs Ministry. Tyson's a Métis activist involved in a range of peace and solidarity struggles against fascism and more. He also serves as General Secretary to the Popular Democracy Movement, an organization he co-founded in Victoria earlier this year. Tyson Strandlin and organizing for a future without fascism in the second half. But first, Dorothea Gucciardo and bearing witness here to Palestine's horrors. Welcome back to the program, Dorothea.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Dorothea, can we begin with the press conference given last week by you and a group of medical professionals, all who have been to Gaza? It was picked up by CPAC. I didn't see it on the CBC for some reason, although I might not have searched long enough. What was this press conference about?
Yeah, so a group of us who have returned from Gaza have formed a group called Eyewitness Gaza. It became very apparent to us that what we were seeing on the ground needed to be shared worldwide. We needed to get out as much as possible the experiences that we had in Gaza. And so we formed Eyewitness Gaza to share those testimonies. And like everyone, we've been watching in horror the last 400 and forever days of this Israeli onslaught of violence against Gaza. And like many people, we wanted to do something. So we formed this collective, and we've been active at protests. We've been active at, you know, with speaking engagements. And this particular press conference was called because 4 months ago in August, we had written a letter to the Prime Minister's office sounding the alarm bells, right? Because collectively, our testimonies were pointing to evidence of war crimes, crimes against humanity, breakages of international law, all of which are in line with other human rights international groups, lawyers who are all saying that what is happening is a genocide. And so we wrote a letter to the federal government indicating, you know, what we had seen, and we made several demands. There must be an immediate ceasefire. Canada must stop aiding and abetting Israel in its genocide. It must enact a two-way arms embargo. Very simple things that the government could do to try to move the needle a little bit. And not only has the government not done any of those things, it has also not responded to our letter. And so a group of us decided to descend upon Ottawa and hold a press conference to reiterate those demands, to remind the government that it has obligations, both in international law, but also to the people, right? The people of Canada, from the protests that I'm seeing, are getting bigger and bigger and bigger every single time. There's a momentum here. Everyone wants this genocide to stop. And so the government has to listen to our will. It has to abide by the rules and its obligations to international law. And so we were there to remind them of that.
Well, I'm certain that the people that work for our government, the Canadian government, are intelligent people. I don't know how much intelligence it takes to discern what's going on over there and to define it. And in fact, as you say, it's been defined already by the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. They've issued reports. They're in plain language that anybody can read. The Canadian government has even made some pretense to enacting arms embargoes against Israel. And yet, on further examination, those are seen to be superficial, and the arms trade keeps going between this country and that.
Yeah, it is completely superficial, right? I mean, Canada is still exporting weapons. It's exporting the components of weapons of military technology to Israel. It is doing so through the United States. It is buying and permitting the import of military technology from Israel into Canada. And there is a documented history of the fact that Israel is using Palestinians to test its equipment, right? Gaza itself has been called a laboratory, that they are testing their equipment, and then they sell them on the international stage and say that these are what? They're battle tested. Well, they're tested on children, right? They're tested on civilians. They're tested on women. We're hearing from North Gaza now, from the doctors out in and around Kamal Adwan Hospital, that they're seeing people coming in with injuries from weapons that they can't recognize. They don't understand what is causing the injuries that they're seeing. This is really concerning. And you're right. The federal government is intelligent. Politicians are intelligent. They know what's going on, which makes their inaction all the more shameful.
Well, and this experimentation and using Gaza as a firing range has been going on for many years, but there's been changes this time around, a lot of different changes. And you mentioned the hospital. I didn't realize there were any hospitals left in North Gaza. And the way that hospitals and hospital infrastructure and medical workers, ambulance drivers, and everybody involved has been targeted specifically. That's new. I don't know that that's ever happened in warfare before. I know if you drop an atomic bomb on Nagasaki, you're going to blow up all the hospitals and kill all the doctors. But I've never seen it where medical professions were targeted specifically, not only where they work, but in their homes as well, and the killing of their entire families.
Yeah, it's atrocious. And the killing of families, the killing of doctors in their homes. I mean, there's evidence to suggest that that is also being done by new equipment, right? By AI generated databases that are providing targets. They're creating kill lists based on what information that is fed into the machine. Nobody knows. The attack on hospitals, I agree with you, it's completely unprecedented. The WHO put out a report recently that there have been 585 attacks on healthcare in Gaza from 7th of October until the end of November. 585 attacks that have resulted in over 1,000 healthcare workers being killed just in those attacks, never mind those being killed in their homes. Right? These are the attacks just on the hospitals. And never mind the number of doctors, too, who have been kidnapped, who have been tortured, who have been detained, who have been raped, who have been murdered. These are acts of depravity that I never thought of, I could ever see in my lifetime, and I'm at a complete loss that we're seeing this. And to your question about the north, Kamal had won all of the hospitals. There were five hospitals in the north of Gaza. All five of them have been damaged. Kamal Adwan Hospital is hanging on, though. This is a space being run by Dr. Hussam Sophia, who you may have seen on social media, because he's been making constant pleas to the international community to do something. They have no equipment. They have no food. They have... this is so sad. They have a decreasing number of staff members because they keep being murdered. They have quadcopters entering the hospital and shooting indiscriminately. He himself was shot by shrapnel. They have massacre after massacre with bodies outside that they cannot get to because it is perhaps unsafe or for a variety of reasons. Either there are quadcopters nearby or it's nighttime and it's unsafe to immediately access them. And by the time they do, they've been eaten by dogs. It is inconceivable to me that this is out in the open, that our intelligent politicians, who are perfectly capable of seeing this happening, and are still doing nothing.
Yeah, we've seen horrors before. I think another thing that differentiates this case is the fact that there is this inaction, and even worse than that, support, Holocaust supporters. I mean, can you imagine? Is not only denying that what's going on, but then supporting the actors committing it. In the CPAC press conference I mentioned off the top, I watched your testimony, and you talk about your trip or your trip's not the right word, but your when you went into Gaza and going through the checkpoints. The restrictions that were placed on incoming medical workers. And to me, it seems like a microcosm of the embargo against Gaza writ large. Can you describe what you were and weren't allowed to carry in?
Yeah, so this is an aspect to the humanitarian aid system that kind of escapes a lot of people, because you hear that doctors are going in. Propaganda is telling us that, quote, aid is getting in. What does that actually mean, right? Yeah, doctors are getting in, but what can they bring with them? And for us, there was a dramatic shift after the Israeli military took the Rafah crossing in May, because prior to that, we were coming in buses filled with equipment, filled with medicine, filled with supplies, right? We were bringing in thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars into the millions of medicine, of consumables, but also things like formula, sanitary pads, baby clothes, you know, anything that could provide a measure of dignity, we were bringing it with us. Once the border was taken and the rotations came through Kerem Abu Salem crossing and put the Israeli military in direct control over who could go in and who could go out, immediately it became apparent that anyone of Palestinian lineage was facing problems at the border. So when I was inside Gaza, I had a delegate with me who was of Palestinian descent. He had entered through the Rafah crossing, and Israel didn't want to let him out. The Israeli government said, we have no evidence of him having entered Gaza. He cannot leave. And if he is a dual citizen, the only way he can exit Gaza is through the Rafah crossing. And I was banging my head against a wall, because the Rafah crossing was not an option. And they knew full well that he was inside Gaza, because part of the application to get in involved sending the application to the Israelis. They knew exactly who was going in. So it became immediately apparent that those with Palestinian lineage were facing obstacles. And then it sort of turned into those of Palestinian lineage are not allowed in at all. And that really reflects the wider inability of Palestinians to return home, right? That's a very deliberate decision to deny this group entry. And then when it came to material things, we were restricted to a small backpack and a suitcase. And you could carry with you 3 kilograms of food, You could carry with you personal medication. It had to be clearly labeled that it was for you. You're not allowed to bring medication for anyone else. Trying to bring in any equipment would be flagged. So, you know, somebody might be able to kind of sneak something in. Unlikely. Anything would require permission. And permission is not always forthcoming. And so frequently you have surgeons trying to enter who aren't able to bring their tools, for example, so they can perform the specialty surgeries that they need to perform. Everything became restricted to personal use only. Even the liquids. Our liquids were restricted to airplane-sized liquids, which makes no sense. This is the land crossing. But airplane-sized liquids is what was permitted. When we crossed in through Egypt, each delegate was allowed to carry with them $10,000 US. This is common when you're crossing borders, right? Well, the Israeli government decided no. Now each delegate can only carry $2,800 per person. Where is that money going? Some people might be wondering. Well, we have expenses. We have to pay rent. I myself have a field clinic and a staff of 12. We have to pay their salaries. We have to pay for fuel. You know, we have to pay for water, for food. We have to be able to sustain ourselves inside Gaza. How can we do that when we're being cut off at every possible opportunity?
And people might not appreciate over here that the prices for those commodities that you mentioned have absolutely mm-hmm. skyrocketed 1,000% and more.
Yes. Yeah, it is shocking how much at the moment I can't come up with any specific numbers, and I'm sorry, my brain is at half capacity these days. But the numbers have skyrocketed. Yeah, the budgets just keep going up and up and up, and so we're constantly trying to play catch up, and it's very hard to even wire money into Gaza. So we were really relying on delegates to be able to bring this in so we could continue operations, right? But everything is being cut off, it seems, at every turn.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Dorothea Gucciardo. Dorothea is a research coordinator for the Starling Center for Just Societies and Technologies at Western. She also teaches history there. She is also a volunteer with the GLIA Project and serves as its director of development, overseeing capacity building projects in Gaza. We're talking about Dorothea's time in the Gaza Strip in last spring, and more generally, the situation there. Tell me about, you mentioned, Dorothea, your field clinics, and can we talk about the GLIA project, what it is? Because it seems prescient that the GLIA project, instead of bringing medical equipment in, works on medical equipment that's already there that is, you know, not working for one reason or another.
Yeah, so the GLIA project was born in Gaza, actually. So our main office is in Canada, but the project itself was born in Gaza, and we have an office there. And it was created in a way to respond to the Israeli-led blockade on medical equipment from entering all the way back in 2012. The solution was, if we can't bring things in, then how can we create them while there? And through rigorous testing with 3D printing technology, we were able to produce clinically validated stethoscopes, otoscopes, tourniquets. In fact, our Gaza office introduced a Stop the Bleed program inside Gaza, training first responders on Stop the Bleed initiatives. And they have been equipped with tourniquets that were printed inside Gaza. The printers themselves, we were able to bring one or two in parts. As people were kind of going into Gaza, they would bring in parts of the printers and then build it over time and then print the pieces that they needed for more printers. And then the plastics, we created what's called an extruder that takes existing plastic, feeds it into this machine, and then it spits out the plastic that can be used to 3D print. And so the whole objective was to make this self-sustaining local initiative where they could create, to start with, simple tools that were very much needed based on the situation on the ground. We responded immediately after October 7 by ramping up tourniquet production inside Gaza. But that ended around November after the eye hospital was bombed, and that was right nearby our office, and it caused all the windows to explode. And so the situation was getting a little bit more dangerous. So we moved away from the office, but the printers are still there. And this is another example of the impossibility of performing medicine in Gaza, because we are stable now to some degree in the south. These printers are located in Gaza City. In order to access them, we need to pass through a military checkpoint that has been created inside Gaza. That means we would need to ask permission from Israel to cross through and to tell them it's to bring these printers back. That's not happening. They're not allowing us to do that, right? This is simply not happening. And so there's the possibility of continuing that project for prosthetics. Like, that's what we're looking at. Can we print prosthetics, especially for children? Because we know now that Gaza has the highest number of child amputees anywhere in the world, right? Like, this is simply because of this genocide since October. And so there's a strong desire to have prosthetics printed inside Gaza and made available to Palestinian children. And we cannot access the printers that are even inside Gaza, let alone trying to bring them in from the outside, because the strip itself has been divided. So there are constant challenges. I'm hopeful that we might be able to bring one or two down. It's something that we are working on, but the likelihood is very slim. And at the same time, I have national staff that is heavily invested in its community. And so we talked about our response options and settled on creating a primary healthcare clinic, which they did in Zawaida in February. It was small, it was modest, it was kind of like a canvas tent. And from there, it has grown. It is a semi-permanent structure. It's seeing hundreds of patients per day that are displaced in the community, making it easier for them to access a doctor rather than trying to get to the closest hospital, which in itself is overcrowded. And so we've never run a field clinic before, but everybody has risen to the challenge. We've been able to hire national staff, and that's been really great. They have been doing such a fantastic job. But it's also very frustrating. We don't want to be doing this, right? Like, I don't want to be running a field clinic. The reason the field clinic exists is because Israel has destroyed the healthcare facilities in Gaza, right? The reason any field hospital exists is because the hospitals themselves are out of commission. And so you have this scenario where it's a group of international NGOs running these clinics to try to provide sustenance, try to provide life to Palestinians in Gaza, while Israel is just bombing the hospitals. It's insanity.
Well, and the patients too. It's normal for us here to expect that the clinic would be seeing the walking wounded and people with gunshot wounds from these awful drone copters that you mentioned, and the bombing and the shrapnel. But that's not it. There's loads of other things that need treating, things that you don't read about in the headlines, but that are a threat to life and well-being equally.
Yeah, in our clinic, what we're seeing in the community nearby is widespread hepatitis A, widespread respiratory viruses, gastrointestinal viruses, skin rashes as a result of living in the tents. We are also seeing malnutrition, evidence pointing towards starvation. We are seeing, now that the cold has set in, cold-related injuries. It's going to be an increase of the respiratory illnesses, and it's not going to get any better until there's any kind of more permanent facilities that can be established, and that can only happen if this violence stops. Right. We had a woman who came in, her entire tent washed away because of the rising seas, because of the winter coming in, because this entire population has literally been pushed to the coast. Right. 2 million people on the coast just trying to survive. It's impossible.
Well, the last time we spoke, Dorothea, we were talking. It was in the midst of a polio outbreak. Was in the news at that time. I haven't heard much about that since. What's happened there? Do you know?
Yeah. So the polio. There was two campaigns, essentially, because there were two shots for the polio vaccine. The first one, I believe, was in the end of August, and the second one was mid to end September. The uptake with the first one was good. We were looking at, I think, over 90% of the target population had been vaccinated. The second one was not as high. I don't remember the exact percentage. I want to say it was somewhere around 70%. So the efficacy of the campaign is yet to be determined. It might have provided some measure of protection, but there are experts who are saying that it's not enough. So it's one of those things where I think time will tell. And the campaign rollout itself was really problematic because there were supposed to be these quote-unquote humanitarian truces or humanitarian pauses where healthcare workers could go out into the community, go out into these encampments and vaccinate the children. But Israel didn't abide by them. The first day of one of the polio clinics for the second round, they bombed just outside of the clinic where children were lined up to receive the vaccine. So I have a feeling that a lot of people didn't go to the second one because of fear, right? Like, we're lamenting and we're frustrated that these hospitals and these healthcare sites are being attacked. Consider it from the perspective of a Palestinian in Gaza. Hospitals had always been considered safe spaces. Now they're places of death, right? They're not actively seeking them out as a place of sanctuary. And so when you're trying to have a vaccine rollout, that's and children have been bombed outside of a clinic, it's going to be a hard sell to have people bring their kids in.
Yeah. Well, anywhere people gather, the chances of being targeted go up. And we've seen that time and again, the bread massacres repeatedly. And Dorothea, we're fast running out of time. Before we go, December 9th is coming. Now, you guys at Eyewitness and others too, I'm sure. I wanted to ask if you're affiliated, Eyewitness, with other international groups that are desperate and trying to do the same thing as you are. But the International Day to Commemorate and Prevent Genocide is December 9th. That is Monday next. What are you guys doing for that?
Yeah, so Eyewitness Gaza, we're hosting press conferences internationally simultaneously to once again try to draw attention to this issue and demand that our governments take some sort of action. It is very significant that we're hosting it on this day because the term genocide is a term that politicians and the media have been very shy to use, and they really should not be. This is a genocide. Human rights experts, international lawyers, eyewitnesses on the ground are all indicating that what Israel is doing is committing genocide. Israel itself, politicians from Israel have told us their intent, and now we are seeing those intentions manifest. We're also really supporting another group called Doctors Against Genocide. On that day, they are going to be hosting international vigils to commemorate genocide as well, and to bring attention to the genocide that's happening in Palestine, because all of us want the same thing. We want the targeting of civilians, the targeting of hospitals, the targeting of schools, the targeting of civilian infrastructure to stop.
And meanwhile, the Canadian government response is lacking. The media is laughable. And the Canadian Medical Association, where are you? It's crickets everywhere, all around. Dorothea, thanks a lot for coming on again and telling us a little bit about it. And remember, GLIA, that's GLIA.org. You can go to their website and support the work they're doing. It's vital work, of course, always. But in this time, it's the import is off the scale. Thanks a lot, Dorothea.
I really appreciate that. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, my great pleasure. I want everyone else to stick around. I'll be back after the break with Tyson Strandlin. He's just back from Venezuela, where he took part in an important meeting there, the Anti-Fascist Youth and Student World Congress. There is resistance, and it is everywhere. Thanks again, Dorothea.
Thank you.
Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio. You're not alone.
kids in Gaza being killed